Hi everyone, I'm Sunny Dutra. I will be the moderator for the call-in presentation tonight, and I am delighted to welcome you to tonight's presentation with Dr. Jill Rathis, who has done some groundbreaking clinical research on dialectical behavior therapy for suicidal adolescents. I'm going to cover some administrative details first, and then I will introduce Jill, and then she'll get started with her presentation. So first, if you're registered for the call-in series, you should have the slides. If you haven't received them or need to register for the series, you can email neacpdcalls@aol.com, and we'll get you registered and we'll get you the slides right away. We'd like to acknowledge the Benderson residents at McLean Hospital and the Clearview Treatment Programs who are generously helping to sponsor this program. If you'd like to make a contribution to NEABPD to help support the series and online archives, which help us to reach a wider audience, please click on the link in the newsletter you received or go to the NEABPD website at www.borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com. Once we get started with the presentation, you can email in any questions along the way or at the end by sending them to neabpdcalls@aol.com. If there are clarifying questions, I may jump in along the way, but in general, I'll save questions for the end of the presentation. We will plan to finish promptly at 9 p.m., and the audio and slides from the call will be archived at www.borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com, so please feel free to pass this on to people in your network. Okay, so with that, I will move on to our introduction. It is an honor to introduce Dr. Jill Rathis, Professor of Psychology at Long Island University at the CW Post Campus in Brookville, New York, and co-director of the Family Violence Program at CW Post. Dr. Rathis has been a pioneer in the treatment of suicidal adolescents with dialectical behavior therapy. She's developed and conducted programs in DBT for adolescents and co-authored the primary text on adolescent DBT, called DBT with Suicidal Adolescents. She also co-developed a new DBT skills module called Walking the Middle Path, which she will discuss in her talk this evening. She serves as a reviewer to several psychology journals, consults on treatment development, participates on National Institutes of Mental Health grant review committees, and trains mental health professionals in DBT and cognitive behavioral therapy. She has published widely in highly respected peer-reviewed journals and written several books on topics including DBT, adolescent suicidality, marital distress, and domestic violence. And I'm particularly excited to report that she has a new book out this year with Alec Miller called DBT Skills Manual for Adolescents, which is available on Amazon and is an incredibly important and valuable contribution to the field and to the treatment of adolescents with BPD. So whether you're a consumer or a family member of someone with BPD, a clinician, or a researcher, I'm confident that you'll find Jill's work to be extremely important and relevant to your work and your experiences related to BPD. And with that, I'd like to thank Jill Rathis for so generously volunteering her time and welcome you all again to tonight's presentation. And I will hand it over to you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that lovely introduction, Clemmy. Okay, so and welcome to all the viewers. I wish I could see you personally, but I'll do the best I can without being able to make eye contact with you and just speaking to you over this medium. So I'm going to be talking tonight on DBT for suicidal adolescents. And the second slide is the outline of my talk. I'll be touching on suicide, self-harm, borderline personality disorder, and emotion dysregulation in adolescents. I'll be talking very briefly about DBT itself and the rationale for using it with the adolescent population. Then I'll be talking mostly about DBT for adolescents, including our adaptations for teens and families. And then I'll be covering the research to date on DBT for adolescents and closing with some future directions. Okay, so my first part on suicide, self-harm, BPD, and emotion dysregulation. Looking at suicidal behavior in the United States, suicide is the 10th leading cause of death across all ages, and yet it's the third leading cause of death among 10 to 24-year-olds, so a very high cause of death for our young people. Among adolescents in the United States, some recent data indicates that up to almost 13% have made a specific suicide plan, and almost 8% have made an attempt. and approximately 157,000 youth receive emergency medical care annually for self-injurious behavior. When we look at NSSI, which stands for non-suicidal self-injury, which is self-injury without suicidal intent, in some ways, this is an emerging epidemic. About 13.2% of adolescents engage in non-suicidal self-injury at some point in their lifetime, based on a huge review. Non-suicidal self-injury is a strong predictor of suicide. The onset of this self-harm behavior most often occurs during adolescence. And fewer than one in four adolescents who report self-harm receive medical treatment, which means that many of these people who are self-injuring may go undetected. And interestingly, habituation to self-harm behaviors seems to occur over time, leading to a tendency toward escalating severity of self-injury. So, people may wonder whether this behavior is of concern and does it really matter if it's not related to suicidal intent. But what actually seems to happen is that it escalates over time, and by repeatedly practicing self-injurious behavior, people become habituated to several aspects of it. They become habituated to fear of injury, which kind of typical people have. They become habituated to the pain, so it actually becomes less painful. And they even become habituated to fear of death from these acts, which is a frightening thing because this behavior often does escalate to suicidal attempts with intent. So why do teens self-harm? In a major review by David Klonsky, teens were shown to self-harm for many reasons. By far the greatest evidence pointed to the function of regulating emotions, so that teens report a lot of severe distress before acts of self-injury, and then they report relief and reduction in negative affect after self-injury. The second most common reason that received the second greatest amount of evidence was a self-punishment function, that a lot of these kids feel intense self-loathing and a feeling that they actually deserve to be hurt, so they want to punish themselves. Other functions, the two categories that received the next greatest amount of support were to feel something, just feel anything at all, and particularly an anti-numbness or anti-dissociation type of function. And then an interpersonal function in which the kids are reporting getting some desired responses from other important people in their environment. So those are the second two greatest reasons in the second category. And then in the third category, with less support, but still some kids reported these as functions, was actually a suicide prevention function, which may seem ironic. Why would you self-harm to prevent suicide? But people actually report that there are some people that report that self-injury is the only way I can keep myself from committing suicide because it's the best mechanism I have for reducing my pain and suffering. There's also a sensation-seeking function, and then another function that would involve autonomy and establishing interpersonal boundaries, sort of a it's my body and I'll do what I want with it kind of reason. But clearly the biggest function is regulating emotions. Looking at the next slide of common motives for self-harm in adolescence, according to two research studies by Nock and Prinstein at Harvard and Yale, they categorize self-injury into two main functions, the first one being intrapersonal and the second being interpersonal. So the intrapersonal functions, again, included that emotion regulation function. So there was a negative reinforcement component with reduction of aversive arousal and regulating emotions, and then a positive reinforcement component where self-injury actually produced some pleasant or desired sensations, again, feeling something or sort of a response. And then the interpersonal function was that self-injury often attains desired social outcomes, and in particular with teens, we see that it tends to increase social support from peers, and it tends to increase the type of desired social support or responsiveness from parents. When we look at borderline personality disorder and suicidal behaviors, we find that among personality disorders, BPD is the most associated with suicidal behavior. And among patients with borderline personality disorder, and we now know with certainty that adolescents can be diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. It's in the DSM-4, it's now in the DSM-5. It is legitimate to diagnose teens. And so with patients with borderline personality disorder, up to 10% eventually commit suicide. That's an astonishingly high number for a given disorder. Up to 75% attempt suicide, and up to 80% self-mutilate or engage in an SSI. Now, on the next slide, entitled Emotion Dysregulation, and when we look at suicide attempts, non-suicidal self-injury, and borderline features, we see that they tend to go hand in hand with Axis 1 disorders and also a cluster of high-risk behaviors. And many of these high-risk behaviors, as well as comorbidity with Axis 1 disorders and some Axis 2 disorders at times, but the high-risk behaviors include behaviors such as school problems, family problems, risky sexual behaviors, substance abuse problems, eating disordered behavior, and externalizing problems. And one way we can conceptualize this cluster of behaviors is as a broad problem of emotion dysregulation. And we know that often when emotions become dysregulated, relationships get greatly impacted and behaviors become dysregulated and impulsive as well. So looking on to the next slide, we want to think about what treatment approaches can we use with this population. Klonsky, Nock, Joyner, independently, and other researchers have called for treatments focusing on emotion regulation, problem solving, interpersonal relationships, and family relationships to best address suicidal behavior and non-suicidal self-injury in youth. So now I'm going to briefly discuss DBT. Where does DBT fit into all of what we've been talking about so far? Well, the DBT model of borderline personality disorder holds that borderline personality disorder is a pervasive disorder of the emotion regulation system, and that BPD criterion behaviors function to regulate emotions or are a natural consequence of emotion dysregulation. So what does that mean? Well, the criterion behaviors of BPD function to regulate emotions or are a natural consequence of emotion dysregulation. So let's take the second part first. Consequence of emotion dysregulation. Somebody gets upset, they get triggered in an interpersonal conflict. So in their very emotional state, they lash out very strongly at their boyfriend or girlfriend, right? That's the consequence of emotion dysregulation. Now their boyfriend or girlfriend storms out. They were already upset. Now they're even more upset. They don't know what to do with themselves. So they quickly have a few drinks and get in the car and start driving really fast as a way to calm themselves down. That's the function of regulating emotions. So, of course, the behaviors tend to escalate problems and create only more difficult problems, but that's how the behaviors seem to function. And so looking on to the next slide, DBT is designed for the severe and chronic, multi-diagnostic, difficult-to-treat patient with both Axis 1 and Axis 2 disorders. The DBT research support for adults now includes about 16 randomized controlled trials at 13 independent sites, demonstrating its effectiveness compared with comparison conditions. And these RCTs have generally indicated that DBT is superior in reducing suicide attempts and self-injury, reducing premature dropout of therapy, reducing inpatient and emergency room admissions and days, decreasing drug abuse, decreasing depression, hopelessness, and anger, and decreasing impulsiveness, all while increasing global adjustment and social adjustment. So I'm now on to the next bullet point on my slides, DBT for adolescents, adaptations for teens and families. So how did we get started with looking at DBT for adolescents? Well, I just presented what DBT is about and how effective it is with adults, so it kind of made sense to consider this for teens. In the 1990s, my first job out of graduate school was at Montefiore Medical Center's Adolescent Depression and Suicide Program in the Bronx, New York, with Alec Miller. The population there in our clinic was mostly suicide attempters, kids with self-injury or suicidal ideation with multiple problems and emotional dysregulation, many with BPD or features of BPD. And Alec and I were given the task back then of finding effective ways to help these kids. We looked at the literature, and at the time, no empirically validated treatments existed for these adolescents. And in fact, the related treatments focused on depression excluded suicidal adolescents or those with multiple diagnoses and comorbidity, or else the treatments were very short-term emergency room based crisis interventions for suicide attempters, so 2 to 6 session interventions just to see them through the crises. So alas, we learned about DBT, which was an evidence-based treatment even then for suicidal patients diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. So we thought that this seemed to fit our teen population really well, and in the 1990s, we began piloting DBT with urban outpatient teens and parents. We noticed that many of them had difficulty reading the handouts and comprehending the material, that their developmental needs were different from the treatment with adults, and especially that the family context needed to be addressed. Families needed to be engaged in treatment, and then the families themselves needed some treatment in order to really help these kids. So we thought we should use DBT. That certainly seems to make sense, but we've got to make it fit well for this particular population, and it's probably going to be different with kids. So we based our modifications on characteristics that were inherent to adolescents. Adolescents differ from adults with regard to emotional and cognitive developmental level. They mostly attend school. They reside with their families and depend on them for daily functioning, including often forgetting them to therapy. So based on these considerations, what were our modifications? Well, we modified the skills training component. We modified the language and the look of the original skills handouts to make them a little more user-friendly for kids. We very slightly reduced the amount of material. We actually started off reducing it by a lot, but over the years, our treatment protocol has gotten longer and longer. And now I actually spend 6 full months on getting through all the modules, which is what Linehan's original treatment did, except that now it's 5 modules, not 4, because we've added a module for teens and families. So it's 6 months to get through all 5 modules worth of skills. We altered the teaching notes, examples, and stories related to each skill in order to be relevant to teens and their lives as well as their family lives. We include families now in the treatment in the format of multifamily skills training groups. And we developed a brand new module called Walking the Middle Path, which are specific to families, teens, and the kind of interactional problems parents and teens experience. We've also added as-needed family interventions. Our first adaptation originally was adding family therapy sessions as needed. And since then, as we've done this for some more years, we've added as-needed parent training sessions and as-needed phone coaching for the caregivers. So with all those changes, what remains the same? And actually, the essence of the treatment is the same. It is unchanged. We still have maintained the dialectical underpinnings of the treatment. We maintain the biosocial theory of the disorder. We maintain the functions and original modes of treatment. We still maintain and we even teach families the treatment assumptions. We have the same targets. We use the same change procedures and acceptance procedures, by the way. And we include the same treatment strategies, the core strategies, dialectical strategies, stylistic and case management strategies. And we've maintained virtually all of the original DBT skills. Some of them we just sort of recommend them to look over on their own, or we do a skill as a quick exercise because we now fit a fifth module into the 6 months. We don't give them all the same time that Linehan originally did, but we did retain virtually all the original skills at this point. So the next slide that says DBT functions and modes talks about the functions that Marcia says that all comprehensive treatments need to have for this population. And so we want to make sure, and Marcia has also said that we can adapt the modalities as long as we keep the functions of treatment in mind and meet those treatment functions. So we retain the five original treatment functions, and this table shows the function, how standard DBT addresses it, and how our adolescent version of DBT addresses it. So the first function is to improve clients' motivation so that they're motivated to get better. And in original DBT, outpatient individual therapy was the mode in which that occurred. But in adolescent DBT, and in adolescent DBT, we retain outpatient individual therapy as the mode in which this occurs. And I actually want to mention at this point that there are residential treatment programs, hospital-based inpatient and partial hospital and day treatment programs, and other modalities or settings as well. And as long as these functions are met, the modalities may vary according to setting. So anyway, an outpatient DBT for adolescents, that's what I'm referring to. So the second function is enhancing client capabilities, meaning we've got to get some skills into them because they're missing some basic capabilities, a core one being the capability of regulating their emotions, especially when very upset. So in standard DBT, outpatient group skills was the place where they acquired and strengthened skills. And in adolescent DBT, we also have group skills training, but we now include parents in the skills training. So we do skills training in a multifamily group format. The third function is assuring generalization to the environment, because it doesn't do patients any good to do a good job in the office and then forget everything they learned or not apply it on the outside. So it has to generalize. So phone consultation was a modality to help with generalization in original DBT. And in adolescent DBT, we have phone consultation, and we also provide phone consultation from skills trainers to the parents because they need to generalize their new skills to their environment as well. They, of course, get upset and might get dysregulated in the heat of the moment just like their teens do. We also include parents in the skills training, and when the parents learn the skills right alongside of their adolescents, we find that that helps with generalization as well. The fourth function is to structure the environment so that it's most supportive of the adolescent's new affective behaviors. And there are case management strategies in DBT and family and organizational interventions. And with adolescents, there's still case management at times. We conduct sessions with families and parents. Those are some ways we help structure the environment. We also sometimes have contact with school or other treatment providers in order to help structure the environment to be supportive. And finally, there's the function of enhancing therapists' motivation and capability And we have the therapist consultation team and standard DBT, and we retain the therapist consultation team as a way to enhance therapist capabilities in adolescent DBT. So the next slide is just a summary of those adolescent modes that I just went through. And we'll go on to the next slide, assessment orientation and commitment. So moving on to assessment, there are just a couple of points I wanted to make about assessment, which include that we think it's really helpful when families come in to first meet with the parents. Many times teens are reluctant to be there. The parents bring them in. They're often bursting down the therapist's door to get into treatment themselves, and sometimes they don't want to be there. And so if you meet with them first, you often just get some shrugs and I don't know and I don't care and I don't have any problems. So if you meet with the parents first and get a thorough history of background and also current concerns from the parents, it gives you a lot more idea of where you can feel around and ask questions to the adolescent. So it's a very effective way of having an idea of what's going on before meeting with the adolescent. And then some good points to hit on in assessment are developmental and family history, current presenting problems, of course, history of suicidal behavior, including NSSI, past treatments, including failed treatment experiences, because that makes many people hopeless about the current treatment, and we want to find out what they didn't like or what do they think went wrong in past treatments, and hospitalization. The reasons for seeking treatment now, or if it's to the kid and they say they don't have any problems, why do you think your parents are seeking treatment for you now? You want to obtain some behavioral definitions of the problem. You want to reframe any judgments or labels about the problems or about the teen as problems of emotional dysregulation and problems of suffering a great deal. And related to that, you want to, as the clients and parents tell you about the problem, you can start to organize them as you reframe them back for the family as fitting right into the DBT problem areas of emotional dysregulation, confusion about self, interpersonal difficulties, and impulsivity. And in our adolescent DBT, the primary targets of stage one treatment, the first 6 months to a year generally, are the same as the pre-treatment phase with commitment obtained. And then the top targets in order of the hierarchy of DBT are to decrease life-threatening behaviors, therapy-interfering behaviors, quality-of-life-interfering behaviors, and then fourth, to increase the behavioral skills of mindfulness, distress tolerance, interpersonal effectiveness, emotional regulation, and middle path skills, which are our adolescent family adaptation. DBT, we retain the original assumptions about patients, and we also extend these assumptions to parents and family members, and we actually go over them on the nights that we do orientation in group. So this first, I won't go over all of them now, but I'll just highlight a couple. This first assumption, people are doing the best that they can, it's incredibly helpful for parents to consider about their teens that they're doing actually the best that they can, even when they look like they're just losing their temper or unmotivated or not working hard at all. But given how they're doing right now and the capacities they have, they're actually doing the best that they can. And it's also really helpful for teens to consider this new idea that their parents are doing the best that they can. But we don't stop there, because if they're doing the best that they can, well, then they can go home, right? There's certainly nothing to do. But here's where the dialectic, the other side, the opposing truth fits in, which is the seventh bullet down. We also balance that idea that they're doing the best that they can with the seventh bullet. People need to do better, try harder, and be more motivated to change. So even though we know you're doing the best that you can, you've still got to do better, try harder, and be more motivated, and this treatment's going to help with that. That last point, the lives of emotionally dysregulated adolescents or group members are painful as they are currently being lived, is also really important for helping dispel some of the judgments or misconceptions, such as the one that kids are just crying out for attention. You know, we don't take their threats of suicide seriously. There's just a lot of, they like the drama. We talk about how painful their lives are and that if they could be doing things differently, surely they would be, but they don't know how. So that helps create some empathy and perspective taking. The next slides are just highlighting some of the standard components of DBT that we also use with adolescents. So the commitment strategies, all the same as standard DBT, really important to get commitment from adolescents because unlike adult clients, they're often brought in by a family member. Many of them want to be there because they're looking for some way to alleviate their suffering. But some don't want to be there, and so you don't want to jump into treatment before you've gotten their full commitment. The next slide is a picture of a diary card. We use diary cards with adolescents, too. We modify this card for each individual, and while we track the typical behaviors like suicidal behavior, urges, self-injury, and drug use, we'll also personalize it for each adolescent's clients, whether it's, targets. So it might involve things like fighting with parents, running away, skipping school, et cetera. The DBT strategies on the next slide are the same, are the core strategies. We still use validation and problem solving, case management strategies, consultation to the patient is balanced with consultation to the environment. With kids, you might have to weigh a little more heavily on the consultation to the environment side and directly get involved with schools, other practitioners, and talks to parents, but it's also really useful to teach teenagers how to advocate for themselves with their teachers and school staff, with their psychiatrists or other treaters, and with their parents. We use the commitment strategies, the stylistic and communication strategies, and of course the dialectical strategies. In individual therapy, the structure is the same. We start sessions with reviewing the diary card, and then we target the behaviors according to the treatment hierarchy, and we conduct behavioral chain analysis to get at the antecedents and consequences of target behaviors, and then, of course, work with the adolescent to do solution analysis and do problem solving about their behaviors. So looking to the skills training, why include caregivers, and why did we think we needed to develop a new module? Walk in the middle path, why did we add that in? Well, the biosocial theory of borderline personality disorder, according to Marsha Linehan, who developed the theory, is that borderline personality features emerge from the transaction between a biological dysfunction in the emotion regulation system and a pervasively invalidating environment. And those two, each influencing each other over time, leads to pervasive emotion dysregulation. Now, the invalidating environment can involve family members. It can also, though, involve the school, teachers, staff, coaches, people in the community, even the culture at large. Lots of things can make up the invalidating environment, but we want to be sure that any invalidation, even well-meaning and inadvertent invalidation, things like "don't worry about it, it'll be fine," which might be invalidating to someone who doesn't think it'll be fine at all. We want to be sure that we get parents on board so that we directly target any part of the invalidation that could be taking place at home and teaching validation, which parents really appreciate too, because when they see that they can respond with validating responses, that's the first step in helping their child regulate their emotions, because when you respond in a validating manner, emotion regulation occurs more easily and more naturally. So we included family members in the treatment. I'm on to the next slide now. First of all, it's consistent with a dialectical approach, which is holistic and looking at contextual factors. We also wanted to directly teach the DBT skills to parents, since they may be dysregulated at times and overwhelmed. It's not easy to parent a teen who's suicidal, self-injurious, and has multiple possible diagnosis, disorders, and also risk behaviors. Parents at times, when they get overwhelmed, may not be interpersonally effective. And when they're emotional, they may be inconsistent or extreme in their parenting. Also, as I said, it intervenes directly to the extent that the family is part of the invalidating environment. And parents also have to be engaged and have a relationship with caregivers to bring their kids to follow through and help their teens solve problems. The parents can also themselves become models for more effective skills use, and it helps with skills generalization by having everybody at home kind of understanding the same terms and speaking the same, more skillful language. It helps structure the environment to be more reinforcing of effective behaviors. When parents see their kids using skills, they can reinforce that directly. It's also exposure for adolescents to parents when they get in the room with them, and they may be emotional triggers where every time they're with them, it's some negative interaction or their emotions get high for some. But when they're in a group setting with other families, with group leaders, practicing very skillful behaviors, their family context as being triggers for them actually really changes, and if they start to associate their families with more skillful and supportive people that they can be with, especially in a supportive environment of group. And it increases social support for parents who greatly need it and also feel a sense of stigma, hopelessness, and isolation. So with DBT for adolescents, here are the skills. We have a multifamily skills training format, and we teach mindfulness, emotion regulation, distress tolerance, interpersonal effectiveness, and walking the middle path. So, again, I already mentioned the family-related modifications in DBT. So we involve family members in the group, and our new skills module aimed for adolescents and their caregivers, walking the middle path, includes skills of dialectics, dialectical dilemmas, validation, and behavior change. So what is dialectics? And I'm on to the next slide on dialectics. Dialectics is basically the idea that two things that seem like polar opposites can both be true at the same time. And related to this idea is that there's always more than one way to see a situation and more than one way to solve a problem. We then teach them how to use this idea in their interpersonal relationships and within their families. They should move from it's either this or that to the idea that things can be both this and that. So, for example, you can work to accept your situation and change it. You might be doing the best you can, and you need to do better. You might say, my mom is really strict, and she cares about me a lot. So we teach them how to apply dialectical thinking to their own lives. And we have them practice looking at all sides of the situation, finding the kernel of truth in every side. Your point of view makes sense, and my point of view makes sense. Related to dialectics, we have developed a set of adolescent family dialectical dilemmas where parents and even kids themselves sometimes get stuck on one of these extreme sides or the other and don't find a middle ground. So our adolescent family dialectical dilemmas, and I'm on the slide with the arrows now, the colorful arrows, are excessive leniency or kind of having too loose a parenting style, or authoritarian control, sort of a too strict parenting style. Those are two extremes on that dimension. Another dimension is forcing autonomy or kind of pushing the adolescent toward independence too soon, or on the other extreme, fostering dependence, doing everything for the adolescent, hand-holding for them, and still treating them as though they're at a younger developmental stage or as though they're not capable. And the third one is normalizing pathological behavior or making light of serious problems versus pathologizing normative behavior or making too much of normal teen behaviors. So the way we work with these is we teach families and their teens these dialectical dilemmas. We ask them all to rate themselves on where they fall out on these dilemmas. Do they flip-flop? Do they tend to be at one extreme? Does one parent take one extreme position and the other parent take the other extreme position? And Then we have them, we talk about what a middle path would look like. For each one, we talk about a middle ground, and we have them, we give them some homework with practicing some middle ground behavior on these dilemmas. And we also have some role play scenarios that we do in the group. We have scenarios we present, and we have them kind of generate in there for practice what would a middle path be, not taking an extreme position. Now, how do you handle the one of normalizing pathological behavior or pathologizing normative behavior if you don't know what's normative for teens? We don't expect parents to be developmental psychologists and just know this. So the next slide shows some sample items from a new handout we developed in Middle Path, and this is greatly expanded in our next book, in our skills manual coming out, where it's now a 2-page handout where we go over typical adolescent developmental stages and behaviors and what's not typical or cause for concern. So example, and then we go over this with parents so they know. So examples of typical teen behaviors on the left are increased sexual maturation, increased focus on body image, and increased self-consciousness. But what would be not typical or cause for concern is sexual promiscuity, binging, purging, or restricting eating, or extreme social withdrawal because of self-consciousness. On the left, it's normal to have increased parent-teen conflict. But what's not typical is verbal or physical aggression, running away, shutdown, and avoidance of all communication. And so on. We go through things like strong interest in technology and social media, which is very typical. But what's not typical is spending so many hours a day that they're isolated on the computer, they're going on high-risk websites constantly, casually meeting partners online or revealing way too much online, that kind of thing. And it's a useful discussion to help parents learn what's normal or what they should really be concerned about. In Middle Path, we also review thinking mistakes, a la Beck's cognitive therapy, such as all or none thinking, labeling, should statements, or having a mental filter, like I see everything I do as negative, because these kinds of thinking mistakes push us toward very extreme thinking and therefore extreme emotions. The next skill in Middle Path is validation. And if you look at the handout with the circular arrows, it's Alan Frazetti's model of invalidation. And we basically teach families the downside of invalidation, that when somebody tries to express themselves and they're invalidated, it increases their emotional dysregulation. They get more upset, more emotional. And so then they're going to have more difficulty expressing themselves. They're not going to identify primary emotions probably, and they'll probably lash out a little bit out of anger and hurt. And when they lash out and don't communicate clearly, they're more likely to pull for more invalidation, which then results in more emotional dysregulation and less accurate self-expression, and so on and so on. We try to turn this vicious cycle into a virtuous cycle if people can increase their validation. And this is, by the way, teens validating parents as well as parents validating their teens. When people validate one another, it leads to more emotion regulation, more expression of emotions, and clearer and more communication, which pulls for more validation and so on. In validation, we teach the definition. We talk about what we can validate, how we validate others, but also ourselves, why we should validate, and then a how-to guide to validation with 6 steps. And our steps range from simply actively listening and staying focused to conveying you understand how the person feels and looking for how their thoughts, feelings, or actions make sense. And we do a lot of validation role plays, and I basically don't let kids or parents leave that room until they all really have produced a validating statement, even when it's difficult. They have to learn new skillful validating behavior. It's really critical, and it's also really a critical skill to have effective separate family sessions. There has to be good listening and validation. So we got to get those skills in their repertoire. The last skill set in the Middle Path module is behaviorism or behavior change. We call it behavior change now. We primarily focus on positive parenting. We talk about spending positive time together and letting each other know what's going well, positive tracking, a method right out of couples therapy, behavioral couples therapy. So we want them to be sure to acknowledge what's going well, what they're happy about, and do a lot of positive reinforcement and shaping. We also teach extinction and ignoring. You don't have to respond to every single negative behavior, and you certainly don't have to punish every single negative behavior, or you get into a cycle of coercion and punishment, which doesn't have good outcomes for kids either. And then we talk sparingly about use of punishment or consequences, because it does have its place. But the problem is upset, dysregulated parents tend to either not use punishment at all or overuse punishment. And so we want them to learn when to use punishment. It should fit the crime, not to overuse it. Use it immediately, briefly. And first, avoid it at all costs if you can, and instead focus on preventing problems, positive reinforcement, shaping, and even ignoring certain things. We did do an initial study looking at the feasibility and acceptability of walking the middle path for both parents and teens, and that's in press right now in the American Journal of Psychotherapy. We found that there's high acceptability of the module for teens and parents. Middle path skills ranked highly among the skills people perceive most helpful, and in particular, the skill of validation was considered the most beneficial skill in all the DBT skills to parents and teens, with reinforcement, positive reinforcement, close behind. So that should be coming out in a few months. We also have some new skills developments and adaptations. I'll highlight a couple here. They're going to be coming out in our skills manual with Guilford that's due out in November. And so in interpersonal effectiveness, we felt that one thing that we saw was not happening a lot was that teens and parents were often not able to see each other's perspective, or that even when things were done out of love and concern, people put, or even out of suffering, people put a negative spin on it. So we introduced a new skill called the Think skill for perspective taking and benign interpretations. And so that's one of our new skills. And in the emotion regulation module, we keep the pleasant activities as part of accumulating pleasant events and positive emotions in the short term and long term. But we've added parent-teen shared pleasant activities, because we believe when teens are still living at home with their parents, so much of their interactions have become negative, and it's important that they have some time together that's pleasant, positive, with no demands, just shooting some hoops or just going out for coffee or ice cream or just fooling around on the internet together, but spending some positive, no demand time. And that, you get a lot of bang for your buck with that skill, because it does a few things. It regulates emotions by reducing vulnerability to emotion, mind, and building positive emotions. It's also sort of an antidepressant, just like behavioral activation and pleasant activities. At the same time, you're improving and you're building a better family environment and building in some better parent-teen interactions. We've also we've expanded the Please handout, so now we have a separate handout just on sleep hygiene and balanced eating, because we find that those particular skills from the Please skills are so important for teens that we felt they each deserved their own handout with very specific steps toward managing sleep and managing eating. We've also added Check the Facts and Problem Solving, which is adapted from Marsha Linehan's new skill of the same name in her Impress manual. And we also added a handout on teen values and priorities, because it's important to know what your values and priorities are before setting your long-term goals. And that's also adapted from Linehan's Impress new skills manual, which will be coming out later this year. So I'm just going to summarize the research to date on DBT for adolescents. The slide listing studies, that's your reference list for you, but I'm just going to summarize with a slide that starts quasi-experimental findings with adolescents. They indicate that DBT is associated with reduced hospitalizations, increased treatment retention, reduced suicidal ideation, reduced depression, anger, anxiety, and sensitivity, and reduced borderline features. The white and green slide that follows just mentions randomized control trials in progress and completed. Cooney and colleagues in New Zealand did a feasibility study, found that DBT with kids and families is indeed feasible and acceptable. Lars Mellum at the University of Oslo, Norway, has done a 16-week study and is finding very promising results. And Marsha Linehan, in collaboration with Macaulay Asarno and Michelle Burke at UCLA, is doing a large randomized controlled trial that's still underway with DBT with adolescents using our model with families. The preliminary RCT data shows that adolescent DBT is associated with decreased self-harm, reduced suicidal ideation, and reduced depression and hopelessness. Moving on to future directions, we need to know if including middle path and including caregivers and treatments enhances outcomes. Our sense is that it does, but the comparison study hasn't been done yet. We're awaiting results from the large-scale randomized controlled trials. Lars Mellum in Norway has 1, 2, and 10-year follow-ups in progress, and Marsha Linehan's data is not out at all yet, but we're eagerly awaiting her findings. And new directions include bringing DBT in schools. Jim Mazza is the primary investigator on that, along with his wife, Liz Dexter Mazza, hoping to bring DBT into general education, health ed classes taught by teachers, just the skills only, feeling that it's a good preventive model to teach kids all over DBT skills. Training models, Linehan has a study in preparation looking at bringing DBT training into graduate schools to train students to do DBT so we have more competent practitioners to deliver this treatment. And finally, quoting from my second to last slide, youth is a time of opportunity but also risk. The risk for us is if we fail to support the growing population of young people around the world, we'll be left to pick up the pieces. And my last thought is that what's so important about DBT is it's not just a suicide prevention treatment, but it's designed to help patients build lives worth living. There's no point in preventing self-harm and preventing suicidal behavior if kids stay miserable. The treatment is aimed, and we've got to keep finding treatments that help them build lives worth living. That's what DBT and DBT for Adolescents aims to do. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rathis. That was fantastic. Really, just that was a wonderful talk and clearly such incredibly important work. So thanks again. We do have a few questions. So the first one is from the audience. He says, thank you for the great presentation. Just wondering if you could share some background or maybe a research citation to support the statement that NSSI makes a person fear death less.
Wait, Sunny, you broke up a little. I heard you say thank you for the presentation, and would you share, and then I didn't make out what you said.
Oh, sure. Yeah, this was This was a question from the audience, and he asked, just wondering if you could share some background or a good research citation to support the statement that non-suicidal self-injury makes a person fear death less, the less afraid of death.
My reference is on the slide. The researcher and suicidologist Thomas Joyner talks about that. And I forget now who else I had on that slide that discussed it. And Klonsky in an ABCT presentation several years ago discussed those findings. If the person were to search, I don't have that slide in front of me at this moment, but the other name besides Joyner, I just don't see who it is right now. And if you search... I know Thomas Joyner discusses it, Joyner and habituation to self-injury, they should come up. I'm sorry, just in front of me,
I
have a specific reference. You see that slide?
2013, I think, is the other one. Does that sound right? Habituation to self harm. On slide 6, looks like Whitlock et al. 2013.
Yes, and that's one of the references. Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, so habituation to self-harm behaviors occurs over time, leading to a tendency toward escalating severity of self-injury.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's the other reference, right?
Great, thank you. And then another question. So reading about this, the middle path model just seems so important and so practically useful, and it really seems to capture, to me it seems like it really captures a lot of the essence of DBT. And I was wondering whether you thought it would be helpful to include more of that direct focus on the middle path for adults as well, or do you really see its efficacy is pretty specific to adolescents?
Yeah, you know, we're always balancing length of treatment with the depth to give them every single thing they need. And the other skills that, you know, Linehan originally developed are just so incredibly crucial that there's nothing I would cut to spend more time on middle path. However, because we also think this is important, what we have started doing a lot, and it's not a formal mode yet, and it hasn't been tested in research yet, but we started offering parenting sessions separately where we teach parents, we slow it down and teach them much, much more on, you know, behavior change, reinforcement, et cetera, validation, even the ideas of dialectics, and some psychoeducation about their teens. And parents with us, we usually offer them, you know, they're in so many forms of therapy with group and individual and as-needed family sessions, they don't want to come every week. But what we'll say often is come for 4 or 6 or 8 parenting sessions, go over this slowly and see how it applies to you. And then they're very happy to do that on a short-term basis, and it seems to really boost the treatment, and we can slow down middle path and give them exactly what they need from it. Middle path, what it does is it kind of introduces them briefly to the idea that, there are other ways of doing things that may be more effective, and then we find that often we do need to offer some parenting sessions to help them really learn them and follow through in detail. So I think that's something we're still trying to figure out, because it's not like we'd want to cut any of the other skills out to do more of it.
Sure, absolutely. Great, thank you. And I wondered, you mentioned kind of the involvement of families and parents getting skills coaching as well, which is such a unique feature of the DBT program for adolescents. I wondered if you might say a little bit more about the importance of that, and in particular even the phone coaching for parents, I thought was really an interesting feature. What's been your experience with kind of how that functions? And
the phone coaching for parents? One of the reasons we put that in is because even before we offered it formally, we found that parents would call us for coaching. They would call the teen's primary therapist and say, you know, hey, this or that is going on. I don't know what to do. Can you help? And we realized that it's just as important that they have somebody to call in the heat of the moment so they can generalize skillful behavior and not trigger or escalate their adolescent and be effective and regulated themselves. So we found that it wasn't effective for them to call the primary therapist of the teen, because that kind of interferes with the teen's trust. Hey, you know, my mom or dad is calling you all the time. How can I trust you? So we've redirected them to call one of the skills trainers for coaching. Mm-hmm. And they don't use it often, but they do use it, some more than others. And just knowing that they have it and that there's somebody to call when they need, since, you know, how do I use, you know, a middle path skill in this situation, or any skill in this situation, helps calm them down and feel like they have more resources, which, of course, is a support to the teen's treatment.
Okay, great. And last kind of quick question. So for adolescents and their families who might be struggling with some of these issues like emotion dysregulation, self-harm, and suicidality, do you have any recommendations for kind of locating resources and taking the first steps toward treatment?
For treatment for getting DBT for adolescents and the families?
Yeah, kind of locating those resources.
Well, the website of Behavioral Tech, behavioraltech.org, which is a training organization, but the website of Behavioral Tech also, anybody can go on it, and it has a resource list. You can click on a link on a menu item that has treatment resources, and I believe it's organized by state. And so, you know, if you're in Florida, you can look, click on Florida and get DBT programs in Florida. And I believe it's listed by whether it specializes in adults or teens or both. And okay. So by state, you can find where all the programs are. Also, there's the DBT listserv, and that's a great resource that's more for clinicians. But if a consumer or family member can reach out to a DBT clinician somewhere and ask and say, you know, I live in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I want to know if there's an adolescent DBT program here. Any DBT practitioner who's on the national listserv or the international listserv can put a call out on the listserv, hey, are there any DBT programs that treat adolescents and families in Cincinnati, and get an immediate response and get back to the family. So that's, okay. Although it's for practitioners, if you can find a practitioner who will put the notice out for you, that's another way. But I would go on the behavioraltech.org website and look at their resources for families and clients.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much. That's really important
Sunny,
information.
Sunny, can you hear me? Because one more question came in, and somehow when I'm emailing you, they're not coming through. Do you mind if I just ask that to Jill quickly?
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah, so the question is, we've come across teens who appear to react very negatively to compliments, even though these compliments may not be invalid in appearance. This leaves parents struggling, as it is so confusing to them that a valid compliment, for example, I notice you're moderating your anger right now, results in much increased emotional dysregulation or shutdown. Do you have a go-to next step recommendation for these families?
Yeah. Sure. It seems so counterintuitive and can be so frustrating when a true, accurate compliment results in negative emotions. And yet, for many teens, this results in either shame, somehow praise has become associated with shame, or anxiety because there's a fear that, oh, now they think I'm all better, or now they'll have higher expectations, and it's just not true, I'm still suffering. So it almost feels invalidating or like too many demands. So what you have to do is find out what is reinforcing to the adolescent. And when we say be reinforcing and use positive reinforcement or shaping, you have to know what's reinforcing to your particular teen. And so if you see that compliments and praise are actually punishing to the teen rather than reinforcing, you just need to find something else that is. And so if the teen's regulating their anger nicely and you want to reinforce it, instead of saying great job with your anger, maybe you'll say maybe they just want your attention but not praise. So maybe without praising them at all, you just stay with them and give them a lot of your attention. Or maybe they've been asking you to take them for sneakers. And so instead of praising them, you say, you know what, why don't we go for sneakers right now? So you can give them a reinforcer without it necessarily always being praised, if you find that praise is not reinforcing for them.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. That was wonderful. Okay, so I will go ahead and wrap things up here. Thank you so much, Dr. Raffa.
Okay.
I really appreciate
thank
your
you for
time
having
and
me.
This wonderful information.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Jill, thank you so much, and thank you, Sunny. And thank you for people who've sent in some donations. It's very much appreciated. And any more that are coming will be equally appreciated.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks.
And next week, Sunny, do you want to announce what we have next week?
Oh, sure. We have, I believe we have Nancy Bloom next week. Let me just double check our calendar. Yeah, Nancy Bloom is next week, and she will be speaking on the STEP program.
Right. Okay, thank you, everyone.